From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Clara Izupitis.
And I'm Dina Sherhan.
This week on War News Radio, Civilian Perspectives. We first hear about Muslim public opinion towards the United States.
Then, we hear about Afghan tourism and its potential for bridge building.
Finally, we discuss the dangers of and preparations for conflict journalism.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
NATO warplanes unleashed one of the heaviest airstrikes in the capital of Tripoli since the beginning of NATO's Libyan air campaign. Over 80 bombs were dropped, almost completely flattening many buildings and areas of Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi's compound. The attacks are expected to continue and intensify until Qaddafi relinquishes power. However, in a pre-recorded speech broadcasted on Libyan television, Qaddafi responded to the attacks, declaring that he is not planning to surrender.
In his final speech before retirement, U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates sharply criticized NATO nations who have had little to no role in the Libyan air campaign and condemned their unwillingness to share financial and military burdens. As NATO airstrikes in Libya have intensified, the seven member nations leading the mission have become overwhelmed by the lack of support from the other 21 members. Earlier this week, Gates specifically identified Germany, Poland, Spain, Turkey, and the Netherlands, urging them to take on more responsibility within NATO. All five countries have yet to respond, and Gates now says that there is a serious possibility that NATO will lose American support.
A U.S. congressional report released this week indicated the possibility of an economic depression in Afghanistan following the withdrawal of U.S. troops in 2014. The report highlighted Afghanistan's dependency on foreign aid, noting that 97% of the country's GDP comes from external military spending in the country, along with international aid. The U.S. has provided Afghanistan with approximately $18.8 billion since 2001, and nearly 80% of that has gone towards short-term projects. Many in Washington are concerned that these projects cannot be sustained without a foreign presence, and officials are working to reevaluate their aid strategy to ensure long-term economic stability in Afghanistan.
This is War News Radio. After the attacks on 9/11, fear and anger often color Americans' attitudes toward Islam, leading many to associate the faith with terrorism and a desire to destroy the West. But what do Muslims across the world think about America and its people? Aliana Bisker Church asks author Stephen Cull, who has a new book on the topic.
Should Americans fear Islam?
Christiane Amanpour, the host of This Week on ABC News, asked this question to a group of six Americans, evenly divided on the issue, during a special report in October 2010. Many of the responses she received, along with public opinion polls, history of racial profiling, and hate crimes across the U.S., show a strong fear of Islam pervading the United States after 9/11. This American fear or anger towards Muslims results from a widespread stereotype generated by Islamist terrorists that all Muslims hate the United States. Peter Gadiel, who lost a son in 9/11, echoes this attitude in his response to Amanpour's question.
I'd like nothing better than to say that I was not afraid of Islam. But the fact is that we have too many history of Muslim terror attacks, and I think to ignore that threat is to ignore the history of Islam.
Dr. Stephen Cull, who we heard from briefly last week, is a political psychologist and director of the Program on International Policy Attitudes at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, and director of worldpublicopinion.org, an international project studying global public opinion. Cull has tried to quantify Muslim animosity towards the U.S. through his recent book, Feeling Betrayed: The Roots of Muslim Anger at America. The book explores the attitudes of Muslim-majority countries over 5 years through focus groups in Egypt, Morocco, Pakistan, Jordan, Iran, and Indonesia. It also includes in-depth surveys in 11 different countries, adding Palestinian territories, Turkey, Iraq, Bangladesh, and Azerbaijan to the aforementioned five. His book has been heeded by Emil Nakhle, former director of the CIA's Political Islam Strategic Analysis Program, and Wendy Chamberlain, president of the Middle East Institute, as an important lesson for policymakers. Kull found that the majority of Muslims abroad do feel negatively towards U.S. foreign policy. He discovered a common feeling of betrayal and oppression from the United States, and explains where this comes from.
The view of the Muslim people on America is heavily conditioned by the perception that the U.S. uses its military force to threaten them, to coerce them, to force them to do things. And they perceive this as being driven by a number of things. One is a desire simply to dominate the region. The desire to dominate the region is seen as heavily linked to oil, but not that being the only reason. And there's also a perception that the U.S. has a hostile attitude toward Islam itself, and that the U.S. is in some way trying to break down Islam, to weaken it, to undermine it, and to ultimately eliminate it.
Kull learned that many citizens in these countries see America as a dominant force that enters the Muslim world to gain something, and through coercion, is usually successful.
There are things that the U.S. does, the way the U.S. uses military force in the region, that contributes to this perception. Specifically on the question of oil, there is a perception in the Muslim world that the United States has effectively made the statement that the U.S. has a claim on the oil in the region. But in the U.S. has never done anything to really clarify that that's not what the U.S. is saying.
The feelings of betrayal and oppression do not color the Muslim population's entire view of the United States, however. Kull's work shows that they are upset with U.S. foreign policy, but do not reject the ideas America represents to the world. A strong two-sided tension results within the Muslim population, desiring, on the one hand, to be more like the West, and on the other, to not compromise their culture.
There is much about the United States, the West, and the larger world that people in the Muslim world find attractive. They're very much drawn to the ideas of democracy. They're very much drawn to the idea of human rights. These are very large majorities. At the same time, there is a concern that by connecting to the outer world and opening up to these liberal ideas, that this is going to overwhelm their culture and overwhelm their Islamic roots.
Kull says this tension can enable terrorist organizations, as the organizations further promote the feelings of oppression and betrayal by the West, though the majority of Muslims do not agree with the tactics of terrorism.
Powering force as a culture as well as militarily. And so all these things get kind of work together so that intimidation by the United States makes them feel that they have to root more deeply in their Islamic culture. And this is a narrative that the Al-Qaeda articulates at great length.
Though supportive of the ideas of democracy and human rights, the Muslim population views the United States as inappropriately directing their countries, especially on the topic of government and religion. Kull found a strong fear of the U.S. trying to eradicate Islam. Many took specific statements and phrases from politicians, diplomats, and military officials as representative of American foreign policy. A significant number in his study referenced President Bush's wording of America fighting a crusade against terrorism as a literal crusade against Islam. In the 11 countries he surveyed extensively, Kull found a majority in each that believed the U.S. has a goal of weakening and dividing Islam, with Palestinian territories highest at 93%, Pakistan at 88%, and Egypt and Iran following in similar mindset. The United States' advocacy of secular government, then, is seen by many as a forced system in contradiction with their beliefs and culture. Kull explains these current sentiments in Egypt.
Right now, there's a lot of effort and money being directed to promoting democracy in the Arab world, particularly in Egypt. And there are members of Congress who are trying to create provisions that say that none of this money, none of these efforts, none of this training can in any way go to or toward helping the Muslim Brotherhood.
The Muslim Brotherhood is now considered a major party in Egypt, with the support of many Muslims who are in favor of religious government, including Sharia law, which is in direct conflict with U.S. goals.
Some members of Congress are very distrustful of the Muslim Brotherhood. And for the U.S. to say, well, we're going to help the secular parties, but we're not going to help Islamist parties is perceived as evidence that the U.S. is hostile to Islam itself. So I think in some way that's undermining the potential for improved relations between the U.S. and Egyptians.
Despite the obstacles facing Western policy and Islamic culture, Cole believes there is potential for enhanced cooperation in the future.
I think with time, there can be greater confidence that the U.S. is not in some way trying to impose on them, or the U.S. is not trying to undermine Islam. The notion that there's a fundamental clash of civilizations and it's impossible for the Islamic world and the West to have any kind of harmonious or cooperative relationship is rejected by a majority of people in the Muslim world.
Cole heard directly from Muslim citizens that they believe this kind of relationship is possible.
In focus groups, they tend to focus on how they perceive the American people and even the American culture as not being like the American government. So they tend to say, yes, there is a way we can enter into a more harmonious relationship. And for them, the key factor is whether the U.S. can enter into that relationship in a way that doesn't impose on them.
For War News Radio, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
This is War News Radio. Afghanistan seems like an unlikely destination for a summer vacation. If the travel advisories published by the State Department were not enough to discourage visitors, access to the country itself remains difficult. However, despite continuing military campaigns in the country, several organizations have taken the initiative to develop tourism in Afghanistan. Sarah Dwyder has a story.
Who exactly takes a holiday in Afghanistan, and why? Mukim Jamshadi, owner of Afghan Logistics and Tours, speaking to us across a noisy telephone connection from Kabul, has some ideas.
Afghanistan can offer different types of tourism. Adventure tourism, kayaking, rafting. The most wanted areas or sites in Afghanistan are Kabul, Shamali Plains, Panjshirvali.
At the end of May, tourism experts and officials gathered in Afghanistan's Panjshir province for a tourism development conference hosted by the Panjshir Provincial Reconstruction Team, a collaborative effort on the part of the U.S. State Department, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Department of Agriculture and Military Forces. Conference attendees discuss ways to develop tourism as a source of sustainable income for the local communities. Ideas included the construction of a library and conference center, as well as the promotion of outdoor recreation like hiking and kayaking. Mark Lederman, the head of operations and longtime tour leader for Wild Frontiers, a travel company based in England offering trips into Afghanistan, elaborated on what exactly it is that draws his clients to Afghanistan and where they come from.
So we offer one trip. It's a cultural trip which doesn't involve any major trekking at all, and it allows people to stay in some of the guest houses, allowing people lots of interaction with local villagers.
These initiatives are only developing an already existing, if limited, tourist industry. Every year, a few intrepid travelers make their way into Afghanistan to visit the sites of the Buddhas of Bamiyan, trek in the Hindu Kush, and kayak across Lake Bandi Amir. Lederman's company also offers a more challenging 30-day trip.
The other trip that we do is called the Afghan Explorer, and that trip is a very different type of trip. That trip does fly into Kabul, and depending on the security at the time, the plan is that we visit Herat Bamiyan, where the Buddhas used to stand. We go up to Mazar-e-Sharif, we visit the Panjshir Valley, and it's a much more all-encompassing trip of kind of Afghanistan.
Regina Shivens, a professor at Massey University in New Zealand, who focuses on the relationship between tourism and sustainable development for developing nations, offered her views of the possible benefits of promoting tourism in Afghanistan.
For some years, it's been recognised that a certain group of intrepid travellers will travel to places that are still considered danger zones. There's been a lot of criticism of people who put their own lives in danger and get in the way of a conflict. There has been a certain amount of attraction of that to intrepid, independent travellers who are used to trading stories of their various exploits along the way, and I don't particularly regard that as something that's that's very positive. However, it is also recognised that tourism can play a place in the rebuilding of country in the post-conflict era.
Jamshedi talks more about these travellers.
Most of our clients, they come from the US, in the UK and Europe, but we take clients from Asian countries as well. But for the Asian countries, the numbers are not as much as the US and UK.
Jamshedi says his clients have heard about Afghanistan and then read books and studied the region before visiting. Lederman found his clients similarly well-prepared.
Everyone's got their own story. I'd say the one thing they share in common is all of them are quite well-travelled. We don't get anyone wanting to go to Afghanistan who hasn't really left Europe before. Most people know what they're doing. They're usually very well-read and very knowledgeable about the destination.
Shivans has some concerns, but also feels good about the people who are interested in these trips.
Other forms of tourism can be more negative if people are not respectful of the culture. But to be honest, I don't think that tourists who just want to lie back on a sun lounger by the pool and snap their fingers at a waiter asking for a cocktail are going to be going to Afghanistan. Different types of tourists who's interested in that experience anyway, and they probably are interested in the people and the culture and the environment.
Several aid organizations, like USAID, the New Zealand Aid Program, and the Aga Khan Foundation, see the potential for a tourist industry in the provinces like Bamyan or Panjshir. Those areas feature an abundance of natural attractions, and organizations have provided funds to train local tour guides and build the needed infrastructure. Shivans explains.
So, for example, the New Zealand Aid Program has invested money in Bamiyan province in Afghanistan. We have a provincial reconstruction team that's working there. People from the New Zealand Aid Program believe that ecotourism offers opportunities for economic development and poverty reduction in Bamiyan. They are trying to rebuild their economies. They're also trying to rebuild their international reputation. And to them, it's almost a sign of approval if they can get tourists back. And it's a sign that they're getting back on track with rebuilding their economy, with providing jobs for people who may have been displaced from their homes and work during periods of conflict.
However, offering tours of Afghanistan comes with its own set of difficulties. Both Jamshedi and Lederman commented on the unique challenges of offering tours in Afghanistan.
The only challenge is the security. There are some security problems in the south and eastern parts of the country, but they are still far from the regions that we are providing for.
With regards to some of the challenges, we're looking at security, obviously, is a key challenge. You know, there is a risk, obviously, in travel to Afghanistan, and what we need to do is to assess those risks to the best of our ability, to minimize them as much as we can, but obviously not at the real point of destroying the reason why people are going there. You know, for example, you could take people around in an armored tank with security on all sides.
Lederman says he wouldn't operate in those situations because the whole point is to break down borders.
To try and introduce real Afghan people to people that are interested in the country, and obviously to allow them to meet us and to, you know, provide quite a unique interaction that isn't between military officials and, you know, kind of high-blown leaders. This is actually just, you know, normal people from the West meeting kind of normal people in the country. So it's finding that delicate balance is obviously a major challenge.
Despite these risks, though, many see tourism in Afghanistan as a worthwhile effort. Shivans explains that tourism can actually help to some extent with the peace-building process.
If it's developed in a way where communities have ownership over the tourism product and they're getting a fair share of the benefits of tourism. So in a place like Bamiyan, if it went ahead and was bringing in sustainable livelihoods for the local people, they were earning enough to justify the effort they'd put into their labour and the resources they were providing for tourism. Then if they're having homestay-type tourism, it can actually be very positive if the tourists going there are those that are more the ecotourist type or those that are really interested in learning about the culture. There can be a genuine cultural exchange that goes on. And that can be very good for developing cross-cultural understanding. That can be a really positive thing.
For War News Radio, I'm Sarah Dwider.
This is War News Radio. The danger of war zones obviously applies to soldiers, but it presents an equally lethal threat for journalists. An unusually high number of journalists have already been killed or captured in America's new engagement in Libya. In the first installment of a two-part series on conflict journalism, Stuart Russell looks into the training, that many conflict journalists use to prepare for such a dangerous profession.
Although the American military has no feet on the ground in Libya, journalists, many of them Americans, have flocked to the country in order to cover the emerging story, putting themselves at unpredictable risk in the conflict zone. Such a chaotic battleground calls for journalists to undergo similarly chaotic training.
The title of the course was, you know, personal safety and security in the field. So there's a girl next to me covered in blood, and there's a lot of people running towards the car, shouting, waving AKs in the air and firing as well. So we all got dragged out, and that became a very real point.
Although the situations conflict journalists work in are nearly impossible to prepare for, many media organizations require their journalists to attend hostile environment training courses in an attempt to anticipate the danger of reporting from the front line. In these training courses, journalists learn how to communicate effectively in chaos, practice emergency first aid, and experience dangerous situations similar to combat. The ultimate goal is to make conflict journalists as ready as possible to face the real thing.
All these people came out with AK-47s and dressed in combat gear, and the lady that was driving the actual van, she hit the brakes really hard because she was worried that something was going to happen, and she saw the guns and she automatically hit the brakes, emergency stop. And another girl that was in the back, she flew forward straight into the into the actual dashboard and cut her face open. And so there was blood all like down her face and stuff, and everyone was kind of looking at her covered in blood and thinking, this isn't fake anymore. This is kind of a real, this is very, very real.
That is Stephen Sidlow, the head publisher of London-based news site Demontics.com, describing his experiences in such a course. These simulations may seem extreme, but they are similar to what conflict journalists experience. Even though there are no international troops on the ground in Libya, there are still journalists' lives at stake. Mohammed Abdel Daim from the Committee to Protect Journalists talks about this danger.
We at the Committee to Protect Journalists have tracked nearly 100 press freedom violations in the country since February 17th. The total number is probably higher. We have been able to independently verify 50 detentions, 5 fatalities, and, you know, scores of confiscations, cases of obstruction, the jamming of satellite transmissions, the cutting off of internet, and more. Attacks on media facilities, destruction of equipment, expulsion. So it really spans the gamut here.
Currently, there are even 16 journalists who have been detained and are in Libyan custody, or at least are believed to be in Libyan custody. Daim concedes that some may have been killed, maybe in hiding, or have otherwise disappeared.
But again, there is overwhelming amounts of circumstantial evidence that those people are in government custody. Let me give you one example. For instance, there are 3 local Libyan journalists who disappeared under mysterious circumstances within 2 hours or less of having spoken critically about the government on Al Jazeera. Where did they go? They didn't go fishing.
In addition, the Libyan government has even deceived the international community about which journalists it is actually holding.
They've also said in the case of at least one journalist that, we have this guy, he's fine, he's in good health, he'll be allowed to talk to his family soon, and they did this for 46 days. And then it was uncovered that the guy had been shot in the desert and killed 46 days earlier. They strung his family and his government and his friends and his colleagues along for 46 days.
The journalist was South African photographer Anton Hammerl. He was reporting from the front line with fellow journalists James Folly, Claire Gillis, and Manu Bravo. When a truck full of Libyan soldiers appeared on the horizon, Hammerl was shot and Folly, Gillis, and Bravo were captured. While Folly, Gillis, and Bravo were imprisoned, Hammerl was left behind, bleeding to death in the desert. Many private security firms attempt to replicate these situations in hostile environment training courses. Courses attempt to teach journalists like Hammerl, Folly, Gillis, and Bravo the proper reaction to dangerous situations, such as a combatant truck appearing on the horizon. These courses are taught by a variety of security consulting firms, including Centurion Risk Assessment Services, AKE Limited, and Red R UK. The fact that many of the instructors at these companies are ex-British Special Forces adds to the intensity of the training. David Swanson, a photojournalist for the Philadelphia Inquirer who took a hostile environment training course with Centurion Services before he left for Iraq, recalls this intensity. He spoke with me about some of the weapons lessons in his course.
One afternoon, they walked us through a field, and there were different markers, different lengths away from us, maybe 100 feet away. They said, you could be killed by an RPG from this distance. Maybe a couple of hundred yards further than that, mortar fire, you were within the lethal range. We continued walking, came upon an open field, and said, where would you think a sniper would be here? And we were all making our best guesses, and it turned out he was probably 20 feet away in the grass right in front of us.
While these weapons lessons were useful, Swanson also learned many first aid tools that would undoubtedly be critical if he or one of his colleagues were to be injured in the field.
Some of the basic first aid will stick with me. That the body needs to breathe, needs to circulate its blood, and needs to get oxygen to the brain. And it's basically, pressure on the wound until you can get better help.
The courses also attempt to replicate the speed with which events can change in conflict zones. According to Swanson, the course instructors simulated this by adding an element of surprise to the training.
We would take a bus from our hotel to the area where we were practicing and having our lessons, and a car pulled up in front of us and a car behind us. They threw a flash grenade, entered the bus through the front and the back.
After having tied the journalists' hands, the intruders went through pockets, taking wallets, watches, and even wedding rings.
And it was just a good lesson, and, what you have on you is you're probably going to, what you have on you, you might lose. But if we were being kidnapped or attacked by hooded people, that was a good sign because they probably would let us free or they'd hold us for ransom. If they were unhooded or, not have a mask on, the chance of being killed was greater because they didn't care that we could describe what they looked like.
Simulations of hazardous situations are important, but proper communication could keep journalists out of these positions in the first place. Daim says that information is the true key to preparation.
When we are contacted by a journalist or a media organization, be it a newspaper, a TV station, a radio station, an online publication, or anything else, we offer our assistance. We tell them the situation on the ground as we report it. We tell them what we've heard from other journalists who were there or who continue to be there. We give them the latest information we can provide. The information is timely and it has a limited shelf life.
The problem is that situations in conflict zones can change so fast. In Libya, for example, the front line can be one town at a certain point, but then a week later, it could have shifted 100 miles east or west. Swanson remembers how quickly war zones can change from the time he spent reporting from Iraq.
When I first got to Baghdad, we could walk around and go to restaurants. And then the four bodies were hung on the bridge, and that all ended. And we were riding around in the dirtiest cars we could find, and dressing in PO overhead and around our face, trying to blend in. It's all such a liquid situation.
Regardless of any communications lessons they learn or any preparations they may receive, journalists who cover conflict must still accept the risks of their profession. Swanson says that this may have been the most important underlying message of his course.
They talked about taking calculated risks. If you're going over there, a lot of people are backing you, a lot of money is being spent. You're there to do a job, and sometimes you have to do things you don't want to do, but you take calculated risks.
Daim agreed, adding that no matter how well hostile environment courses may prepare journalists for places like Libya, there is just no way to circumvent the danger of war.
It is a high-risk activity by definition. So, there is no ways to prepare in order to make it risk-free. The way to make it risk-free is not to go.
For War News Radio, I'm Stuart Russell.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our website.
Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Clara Izupidis.
And I'm Dina Sherhan. Until next time. Thanks for listening.